Welcome to Small World of Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Luke Lytle, and today I'm having a discussion with Dr. Mara Carlin. Dr. Carlin is a professor of practice at SAIS and is the co-lead for the Security, Strategy, and Statecraft focus area. She served in national security roles for six U.S. Secretaries of Defense, advising on policies spanning strategic planning, defense budgeting, the future of conflict, and regional affairs involving the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. Most recently, she served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Plans, and Capabilities, the Pentagon's Chief Strategist, leading the development and implementation of the 2022 National Defense Strategy, Nuclear Posture Review, and Missile Defense Review, the first time all major strategies were conducted simultaneously. She's written two books on military history and policy and has both her PhD and master's in strategic studies from SAIS. Our discussion focuses on the national defense strategy that she supervised, the nuts and bolts of integrated deterrence, and the national security issues that face the United States in the near future. I think you'll find the discussion truly engaging and exciting, especially if you're interested in working on or studying deterrence policy. Let's get to it. Dr. Carlin, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today, and welcome back to SAIS.
Thank you for having me. It is such a treat to be back at SAIS.
It's great to have you back. So how does it feel to be back at SAIS after your previous job at the Pentagon?
Oh, it's good fun. I mean, I am always awed by just how bright and thoughtful SAIS students are, how comfortable they are hearing and debating different perspectives. And frankly, I don't know that students always realize that the professors are often learning as much from them as vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an amazing part about the grad school dynamic, especially. I agree. And I'm going to be teaching at West Point after this, and I'm really excited about that aspect of the whole experience.
I'm so excited for those cadets to learn from you. And I think that you will find that few folks in your career will push you as hard as students, right? Few folks will be as willing to ask you those thorny questions and really try to get at the heart of what you're arguing and why you're arguing it. And I suspect you'll learn a lot from that.
I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be great. Speaking of teaching, can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be teaching at SAIS and maybe separately what you're going to be researching, any other projects you've got coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, as you know, since you get to suffer through it, I'm teaching strategy and policy, which is a really fun class I've taught before on kind of the history and future of warfare. And I really enjoy teaching this class. We always get a neat group of students. And end up reading a lot, debating a lot, and really trying to think hard about the frameworks and the theories that we want to use for understanding the future contours of conflict. Next semester, I'll be teaching on leadership ethics and decision making, which I'm so excited about. And right now, I think I just want to assign about 1,000 pages of reading a week, which is clearly not okay. Leadership has been a topic that I think has probably interested me since kind of my early days in government, recognizing how different kind of jobs and positions and issues and dilemmas look based on who's in charge, how well they do or do not get along with the folks around them, the extent to which they empower their staff, are willing to hear different answers. And, you know, a lot of the issues I've worked are just kind of riddled with ethical dilemmas. So I'm psyched to talk to students and learn from students about this topic. In terms of research, there's really two topics that are in my brain right now. One is really trying to understand the lessons learned on the changing character of war based on three laboratories that we see right now. Russia's war on Ukraine, the many intertwined and tangled conflicts in the Middle East, and efforts to test deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. So I want to try to understand, as the United States moves beyond the post-9/11 wars in particular, how should we be thinking about the future contours of conflict? The next piece is probably a bit related to it, but I had a book that came out while I was still in government called The Inheritance, and it's trying to understand the legacies of the post 9/11 wars on America's military. And so I had this kind of funny situation where this book came out and I wasn't obviously in a position to talk about it or really interrogate it and hear folks' views. So I'm excited to start doing that. Looking back, seeing what sings and what resonates, what doesn't, how and what ways events over the last 2 years or so perhaps have shaped some of the kind of hypotheses and arguments that I made in the book.
That all sounds like really fascinating work. And I think you're uniquely suited at the intersection of strategy and leadership. In your previous position, you were leading a team or a group of people that was working on the big strategy, the national defense strategy. And so I'm curious, in that position, in that job, and in your previous time at the DoD, how have those jobs influenced your perception of strategy or your idea of what strategy is since your last time at SAIS? How has your conception of strategy changed, especially after the work you did on the NDS?
Absolutely. So I've been in and out of the Pentagon a lot. I've actually worked for 6 secretaries of defense over the past 20 years or so, and having touched different types of strategies and different strategies, I would say that they are always going to be unique based on the personalities that are involved, the processes that are followed, and obviously the issues that are being kind of debated and decided. I think where I've come down on strategy is the very best you're ever going to do when you're building a strategy is get folks to agree on where you are and where you're going. And actually, that first piece is just as important, if not slightly more so, than the second piece. Because if folks don't really agree with where you are, right, how capable is your force? How well is it staving off challengers in various spots? How integrated or dysfunctional is it? Then it can be really hard to actually figure out the trajectory that makes sense and to knit that together in a really effective way.
So the national defense strategy that you played a key role in writing has a big focus on the concept of deterrence. That's going to be our primary topic today as we go through this discussion. And we can range off to other topics too as the conversation takes us, but let's establish a baseline for our listeners, assuming that most of them understand generally what deterrence is. Can you take us through a summary of what integrated deterrence is specifically?
So in looking at this issue, it helps to really note that there was something special about the 2022 National Defense Strategy, which is for the very first time, it was an integrated strategic review. What that means is all of the major reviews, the National Defense Strategy, the Nuclear Posture Review, the Missile Defense Review, were all done in one kind of integrated forum. That makes a lot of sense, right? The last thing you would want to do when you have increasing domains, increasing challenges, increasing capabilities, is to try to kind of siphon them off and say, no, we're going to stovepipe. If you worry about nuclear weapons, you just go over here, figure out how you understand the future security environment, and just let us know what you want to do, right? It doesn't make sense to do it that way. And yet, the Department of Defense hadn't taken this approach before. So to be frank, when I had pitched this idea of doing all of these strategies in an integrated manner, I think there were some folks who, for very understandable reasons, were skeptical. How could you simultaneously do these 3 big reviews? How could you make sure that they complemented one another and that they really not just rhymed, but sang to one another in a thoughtful way? But it worked. I mean, it worked not least because of Secretary Austin's tremendous leadership in making it a reality. So in doing this national defense strategy and the attendant nuclear posture review and missile defense review, I think it was pretty clear early on where the focus needed to be, right? In that really is the pacing challenge of China, where you have a country that has the will and increasingly the capability to fundamentally reshape the global security order. That, of course, is paired by the challenges posed by Russia, which is seen as an acute threat, Iran, only getting more complicated, North Korea, getting ever more capable, and violent extremist actors as well. And so I think a central dilemma is, how do you effectively prioritize when you know that one of these is fundamentally more of a challenge than the others, but then give sufficient attention to an action toward those other issues that are not going away? And I think that was in many ways the kind of key challenge of doing that national defense strategy. That required focusing in on where the U.S. military is fit for purpose, right? How making sure that you got a combat credible military that, should deterrence fail, is ready and able to successfully prevail in conflict. The first part of that is obviously key, right? Deterrence. Deterrence, a concept that in many ways, I think, hadn't been prioritized in the post-9/11 wars because it frankly didn't seem as terribly relevant when the United States is dealing with challenges from groups like Al-Qaeda, for instance. And so really needing to both kind of bring back that idea of deterrence and then refine it and expand it in a way that's relevant, where you've got not just one strategic competitor, but two, and other challenges ahead. So there was a lot of effort that we spent on that deterrence piece while making sure fundamentally, right, deterrence only works if folks know that you've actually got the capabilities to do the things that you say you might do, while making sure that we're building combat credible force.
Integrated deterrence has a few levels to it, from what I understand, from what you've said. There's an interagency integration. There's within, you know, the military itself at a lower level within the Department of Defense, and then international, you know, allies and partners and with the coalition. Is that accurate? And a follow-up to that, do you think any one of those is harder to do than the others?
Effectively, it's working together for a common purpose. So working together across the Department of Defense, across the interagency, and with allies and partners. It's as simple as that, right? And you've got a tailored purpose for which you are collaborating. It is, I think, been applied particularly effectively in the case of responding to Russia's unprovoked war on Ukraine, where across the Department of Defense, you had folks both baseline and deeply understand how and in what ways the different domains were working together, right? So you can't just say, hey, I'm only worrying about maritime, for example, or ground or what have you. Space matters, cyber matters, et cetera. It's been applied, I think, quite well in this case as well across the interagency, where in addition to having the U.S. military piece, you've got the State Department's efforts at diplomacy, you've got the Treasury Department's effort at sanctions, et cetera, kind of all working in harmony. And then obviously on the allies and partners front as well, you know, where you've got 50 plus countries that are convened every single month by the Secretary of Defense to help provide military assistance to Ukraine. So which is the hardest of those is a great question. This isn't a cop-out, but it will depend a little bit on the context that you're looking at. And you might be surprised at what's easier. So if you had told me in February 2022 that it would be possible to convene 50 plus countries every month to try to support Ukraine's military for more than 2 years, I would have been astonished at the notion. And yet, like clockwork, that's exactly what does happen. In the post-9/11 wars, a lot of folks used to talk about the whole of government. And something quite disparagingly, for example, in my book, The Inheritance, I quote someone who talks about the whole as in H-O-L-E of government, because effectively they're saying that just didn't work. And they had all sorts of reasons and experiences in which they felt like different parts of the U.S. government weren't showing up, say, in trying to work together in Afghanistan. And then, of course, when you got just the U.S. Department of Defense, this is a behemoth, right? At a minimum, even understanding what every piece of that department is doing vis-a-vis a challenge, or that might have echoes for a challenge based on what region it's in, can be incredibly challenging. because you want to be able to empower folks, right? You want folks at the combatant commands across the military departments to be running hard and running fast in pursuit of the priorities. Also need them to be really cognizant of the impact of their actions and activities on whatever the issues are of the day. So it's a little bit idiosyncratic to the kind of context, I would say, which can be the toughest.
A lot of our listeners are going to be students, grad students, and young professionals working in government. And even at those lower levels, we have to integrate a lot of different things, even in the Army, joint operations, combined operations. We try to integrate a lot of disparate entities and things like that. What advice could you give, or what lessons have you learned about trying to integrate various entities and agencies together in a bureaucratic organization towards a common goal?
First is really clarity of intent. What are you trying to achieve, and how do you plan to achieve it? And within that, what do you see as the roles and missions of the various actors? Right. So often, and I would say the Department of Defense is a perfect case study here, folks want to be helpful, right? They want to be collaborative and help solve a challenge. That's like the sine qua non of public service in many ways. But they're not exactly sure how and in what ways to best do so. So helping folks understand the intent and how best to achieve that intent is really critical. Having forums in which folks can air debates and dilemmas about how best to make that a reality is also really critical, right? It demonstrates an appreciation and understanding that the leadership doesn't have all of the answers, obviously, and that, you know, those other folks are relevant, not just for kind of being cogs in a machine, but for actually helping meaningfully achieve that end state. And look, some of that's going to happen in formal forums. Some of that will be more informal. But folks need a way to be able to feel like they can raise their hand and say, hey, I'm not exactly sure about X, or I don't think Y is having that impact. And so obviously a lot of that comes down to just having a pretty healthy command climate with a regular battle rhythm of interactions, so folks know when they will be able to share what's working and what's not working.
That's great. Thank you for that insight. We're going to dig a little bit deeper into deterrence now, into the main topic of our discussion. You've said before, you know, there are different modes of deterrence, so to speak. You can have deterrence by denial, deterrence by cost imposition, and you've mentioned one that is deterrence by resilience. And you've noted that this is an area ripe for study before. Can you explain a little bit what deterrence by resilience is and why you think we need to put a little more attention on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, writ large, our thinking on deterrence does need to mature and evolve. So much of this is originally based, of course, in the literature on nuclear weapons. That space has gotten more complex, for example. Moreover, the context has also just gotten a lot wider given various domains and various actors. The deterrence by denial of benefits, deterrence by punishment, I think pretty clear to folks generally. Deterrence by resilience was a little bit of a slightly innovative approach that had been suggested in the National Defense Strategy. And effectively, it means that one can ride out or really preclude the impacts of what an adversary is trying to do, right? So you could imagine a massive adversarial attack on your critical infrastructure, for example. And because you have built a resilient cyber infrastructure and architecture, their attempts don't have the impact that they would like. That means then you are in a position to step back and then escalate really on your own terms or choose not to escalate. Resilience isn't terribly glamorous, and yet in many ways, investing in resilience just provides so many more options.
Without commenting on its effectiveness, do you think the coalition efforts to defeat Iran's large cruise missile attack on Israel is an example of that?
I have actually been debating that exact question in recent weeks and going back and forth with other really smart friends. I think I have landed in the place that it is closer to denial of benefits. But I think you're asking exactly the right question, and that requires some deeper exploration. It is a great case study, though, in, look, if you had told me a decade ago, 5 years ago, a year ago, that Iran would do a massive conventional attack on Israel, and much of the reason that the impact of that act was prevented was because you had a whole loose coalition of countries cooperating to be able to see and then shoot down. And also you had a bunch of really terrible platforms. That would have been astonishing, right? There have been efforts to bring countries across the Middle East into an integrated military construct since I first joined the Pentagon 2 decades ago. And we just saw the fruits of that. That's kind of incredible.
Right. I mean, I was about to say, it looks like we're already reaping some of the fruits of this idea of integrated deterrence, looking at it that way.
I think so. Since we're on the topic of deterrence, what I've been cogitating a bunch on related to this case study is it's pretty orthogonal to how the Iranians have responded to actions in the past. I mean, particularly vis-a-vis Israel, usually they would do so in sort of that shadow war way in which you expect some sort of actions, usually a bit delayed from the initial event, usually pretty ugly, but not conventional. And so I'm just quite curious to, I think, re-up and reconsider from Tehran's perspective how they think about deterrence, where they see themselves as having been effective or not effective. Obviously, you've got a whole bunch of examples vis-a-vis the United States and their efforts to support militias attacking U.S. troops in places like Iraq and Syria. So we've just seen kind of a twist in terms of capabilities and their use. And I think that requires probably updating our understanding of how Tehran is trying to deter. And obviously, to be effective, one really has to figure out what signals are you sending the other team and what's the noise around those signals. And this is one where I think the signals are not so clear.
That's for sure. And it's such an interesting dance to watch. That's kind of how I think about it. When they or one of their proxies attacks a U.S. base, and then we respond perhaps with some kind of an attack, and there's a bit of an escalation and then a wind down, and there's signaling and messaging within those attacks. And then I'm sure there's a bunch else that goes on as well. And it's this very delicate dance, trying not to tip it too far, but to send the right signals both to each other and to our own domestic populations as well, which I think is part of it.
Absolutely. And it's like rarely a two-player game, right? I mean, in this case study in particular, right? You've got a whole bunch of different actors within systems, being complex actors, obviously, and then kind of across systems as well. Later on in the semester, we're going to read Roberta Wohlstetter, who talks a lot about this idea of signals and noise and when it hasn't worked out so well. So it'll be fun, I think, for us to read that and read her smart work and try to debate how we can update this thinking on deterrence more.
Really excited about that. That's going to be great. Speaking about updating our understanding of deterrence, I want to ask if you have any advice for students, or if you were to tell a student who's interested in studying deterrence, what should they start looking at? What concepts should we explore? Or even young professionals who are trying to understand deterrence better, where should we be looking? Where can we push the boundaries a little bit?
So one area that requires a lot of exploration is deterrence across domains. So what is it that you're doing in one domain like cyber that is going to have echoes in another domain like ground, for instance? And I just don't think we've quite gotten that. Obviously, it's going to depend a lot on the actor you're talking about. But there is something there to be figured out. So if you want to try to tackle that, obviously you want to start off with like building a rich understanding of the different domains and then trying to think through how they might complement or, you know, activity in one might complement or contradict activity in another. Because, you know, I think folks understand at the most superficial level, you know, just because a country does something in X or Y domain doesn't mean that they expect a response in exactly that domain. But what are those expectations? And ideally, how do you knit all of this together if for an effective strategic approach? Then I would probably say just start studying case studies, right? I mean, there's nothing better than getting a laboratory of a case study and trying to understand what worked and what didn't work.
So do you think... Yeah, I'm sure deterrence across domains and studying that depends on the actor that you're looking at too, right? Based on how they fight, how they operate, they may respond differently than another actor. So you need some regional expertise as well, or at least expertise on a specific actor, a target of deterrence, to see how those domains are going to interact, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. So you're looking across a couple of different axes. You could look across domains. You've got to have it relevant to the, you know, to the context. You've got to be able to look at the actor and the relevant parties that are going to be involved, which is why I think it is useful to pair building knowledge of these different kind of topics with actual examples to then try to flesh out. Simulations are always good fun as well. I know SAIS has had a long storied history of crisis simulation, which is an incredible class that I taught for a number of years. And I think that can help you try to game this out as well, because there are, you know, finite number of examples if we're particularly trying to talk about some of the newer domains like cyber and trying to apply them in a thoughtful way.
So one more general question about deterrence. There have been a number of academics recently who have asserted that deterrence needs to be balanced with assurance to be the most effective, you know, providing assurance to an actor that if they don't do the things we don't want them to do, or they do the things we want them to do, then they are assured that there will be some benefit reaped from that. Is that an accurate conception of that? What's your take on this?
The concept of assurance has never sung to me, because it has seemed to me it is an inviolable part of deterrence, right? If you are effectively conveying what you will or what will not do under certain circumstances, that means that you have been able to help them understand when they should feel comfortable and when they should feel less comfortable. But I've not quite understood why it needs to be its entirely own ballgame. Moreover, when folks talk about assurance as it relates to like allies, for instance, so much of that is going to come down to demonstrating to them that you have the will and the capability to deal with this problem that they see ahead of them. And, you know, all of the words and meetings aren't going to actually satisfy them sufficiently in the same way that being able to show them that you're serious enough to have made those investments and exercise those investments in a way to meet what I assume are your mutual needs.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of implied with deterrence if it's being employed properly. And the signaling is proper, the assurance will come with the policy that you implement. So now this is a bit of a trickier question, but one that I have been fascinated by, and I don't know if there's a good answer for it. So the base question is, how can we tell if a given deterrence policy that is being implemented has worked or is in the process of working? If a deterrence policy works, how can we measure how effective it is as it's being implemented, and then, you know, therefore make an adjustment to make it more effective? And I'll just briefly list an example here to make it a little more concrete. So for example, we really want to stop country X from launching an attack on country Y. So we move some military assets to a nearby allied country, and we signal to country X somehow that it would be a really, really bad idea for them to try anything against country Y. Is there a concrete way that we can measure whether or not that move and that signal has made it less likely that country X is going to attack country Y? Do you think that's a possibility?
Look, that is the ultimate question, right? When do you know if you've succeeded? Or were they never actually going to do the thing? Or did something else that someone did actually play the kind of key role in changing their approach? Look, it's going to be imperfect, but we're all going to be doing it anyway, so we may as well do it deliberately, right? We're all going to have our hypotheses based on our backgrounds or experiences that say, oh, yeah, that absolutely worked for XYZ reason. What I think is most effective is if you can actually put that out and state it quite clearly. For it to work, you've got to have a good understanding of your baseline, right? So it's not as though like relationships between countries start at the stop, you know, at the drop of a hat usually. So what's the history of these two countries on this issue? And more broadly, what have been the signals that each country has picked up from the other in the past? And where do you think that they are going to be kind of where they're going to be kind of listening as much as possible, right? What's going to be sort of the outsized variable in their minds? Once you've kind of laid out that picture, then it really becomes, I think, a question of playing it out, seeing the different ways in which they could respond, and then measuring your impact. Again, it is inevitably going to be imperfect, but not doing it seems to be downright silly, since we're going to just have our own hypotheses no matter what, right? Because there's going to be time, attention, resources. There could be spectacular events that occur as well. So building that baseline and then developing a feedback loop to try to figure out, all right, we called that wrong or we called that right. One of the dilemmas inherent here is that sometimes the price for stopping that action is just much too high, right? And it's actually not a feasible option based on the leadership. So under those circumstances, really having a deep, rich understanding of the constraints one is working under, can you stop this action? And if not, what is the sort of good enough approach you can do to, if not stop, and at least like stymie or impede that action?
That makes sense. Yeah, that's a tricky question. It's very nuanced. And like some of the other stuff we talked about, it's country dependent, it's leader dependent, since there's a lot of, there's a psychological decision-making aspect to it as well, which we could go down. But we'll take a step back from the turrets now, because we've definitely gone very far down the rabbit hole, and it's been a fascinating discussion. But going back out to your experience with the 2022 National Defense Strategy, I'm curious if there were any, and not just the defense strategy, if there are any historical case studies or examples that you used as you were drafting it, or more generally, your time at DOD, were there any historical case studies that you found were really helpful to look at or really inspiring?
Well, I think I can probably answer this in both like a superficial and substantive way. The more superficial, or maybe you could say like bureaucratic, way that I would answer this is having worked on a number of different strategies, national defense strategies, national security strategies, strategies that are more targeted, say like the counter-ISIL strategy. I really came into this national defense strategy process taking the lessons from those and thinking very hard about implementation. I've worked on strategies that went and sat on a shelf, to be honest, and then others that became sort of the lifeblood of whomever was supposed to implement that. And so really tried to bias towards what effective implementation could look like for a strategy. And that required a 360-degree approach in which you had the most senior to the most junior folks across an entire department all seeing this as their North Star and feeling on the hook to make that a reality. In a more substantive way, I would say probably there's a number of case studies that have jumped in my brain. So having spent years writing a book on how the U.S. builds partner militaries, in looking at how the U.S. and a whole bunch of other countries have built Ukraine's military more recently, have equipped Israel's military, I've thought a lot about the case studies in which the United States has attempted to do this exact thing and hasn't done it terribly well. There are examples, frankly, in every region in which that's the case. Sometimes it's because the U.S. doesn't have the right people involved. That's what happens when the U.S. tries to build South Vietnam's military before that explodes into a spectacular war that ends up costing 58,000 Americans and untold numbers of Vietnamese lives. Sometimes it's because there's a superficial understanding of the other actors that are involved. This ends up happening in Lebanon in the 1980s and then throughout the 2000s. And sometimes it's because there'll be a real technical approach to how to work with partner militaries. And joke, this is like the Excel spreadsheet approach, which effectively means you focus on, I gave them X, I trained them on Y, therefore, you know, they can do all of the things. And it seems to forget that ultimately these are political endeavors. And so having thought a lot about some of these case studies, there's one in particular where I think the United States was able to pretty effectively build a partner military, and that's Greece's military just after World War II. It's recognizing this is ultimately a political, not a technical endeavor. And that was in the back of my brain a lot as the Russian war in Ukraine kicked off and as this massive effort to equip Ukraine's military has kind of gone through all of its twists and turns. And in particular, thinking through what capabilities does it make sense for Ukraine's military to have in line with the challenges it faces? And along those lines, which ones don't trip red lines? Which ones can they use most effectively? Which ones can be delivered, you know, in a kind of timely and relevant manner? So that's probably, I think, like a functional topic in which the history has been really loud as I've worked on a contemporary case.
Yeah, and examples of integrated deterrence, too, at its finest.
Mm-hmm. You know,
working with other countries, building their militaries to increase capabilities. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I wanted to end with one more question. Going back to CICE, this is a question that another CICE professor I've studied under likes to bring up. What is an issue or a part of the world that you don't think we're paying enough attention to right now that we'll look back on in 30 years from now and think, how did we not see that coming? What are you worried about right now? It's something that we're not paying attention to.
For 30 years from now?
Any extent in
the
future.
Well, the timing matters, right? Let's do 30 years from now. I worry a lot about what's happening in West Africa, and in particular what has been kind of nicknamed a coup belt of sub-Saharan Africa. You see metastasization of ISIS. You've seen pretty active Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. You see the Wagner Group kind of mucking around there as well. And when you look at all the statistics about the massive kind of populations of young people that are increasingly going to be shaping Africa and in particular the international community, I worry that they're just, you know, this area is just not getting kind of the time, attention, and definitely not the resources that it needs to not just stabilize, but also to be able to succeed.
Do you think it might figure a little more prominently in the next national defense strategy or one coming up? I know this is a speculative question.
Yeah. I think the next national defense strategy has to tackle what we are increasingly seeing as some sort of alignment among a number of different adversaries. So you see Russia-Iran relations that have gotten stronger, Russia-North Korea relations have gotten a lot stronger, Russia-China relations have, although there's some interesting ceilings that have emerged along those lines. China-Iran, effectively, there's something happening between and among some of these partners where they're coming together in what may appear to be just transactional ways, but actually in reality may be a bit bigger. And it's not as though we haven't seen cooperation among adversaries in the past. We really haven't seen it, I think, to this scale in a very long time. And in particular, where it could be so dangerous. So It would seem to me if I were asked for advice on the folks who, bless their hearts, get to build the next national defense strategy, I would recommend that they really try to dig into what's coming out of these relationships, what are the limits of them, and above all, how do you impede them?
Maybe we could draw from Clausewitz and Sun Tzu a little bit about disrupting enemy alliances, things like that.
That's, absolutely.
That seemed that'd be apt. Already using
sounds,
stuff from the class.
That sounds appropriate.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Carlin, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the class. And again, thanks for coming on.
Truly my pleasure. Thanks for having me and for doing this.
Thank you for joining us on Small World, Big Problems. We hope you found our discussion as fascinating and helpful as I did. If you're interested in more discussion on strategy and security topics, please subscribe to the show on whichever platform you get your podcasts. I'm Luke Lytle, your host, and this has been a production of the Johns Hopkins Seitz Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. We'll see you in a few weeks for the next episode of Small World, Big Problems.